Welcome back. We missed you.
We missed them.
Right?
The Lord be with you. Buffy, that's my wife for all you newcomers out there. She once told me that I wouldn't be a very good salesperson. She said this one time when I was trying to sell my 1978 Suburban. I put an ad in the paper, and by her measure, I was too quick to point out all the flaws, the broken parts, the worn bits, that other missing part, the button that sticks, the rust. Oh yeah, that other rust that you can't see under here. To be clear, she wasn't advocating that I do anything dishonest. She just said I didn't need to highlight all of the truck shortcomings. And I'm not a hero or anything. I just wanted the guy to know what he was buying. I've been on the short end of a few raw deals, as I'm sure many of you have. Well, today, that same salesman stands in the pulpit today. In some ways, today's parable that we just heard read feels like a really hard sell. For my money, if I had my way, I'd rather see you go home today with one of those trim and pretty little parables that starts with something precious and lost and ends with a barbecue and a rump-shaken block party. And yet, so long as we're working our way through Matthew's gospel, that isn't going to happen. In Matthew, Jesus isn't worried about hurting our feelings. Here the stories don't end with parties, with fatted calves. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus is much better at making us sweat, making us squirm, even when he's reassuring us of God's goodness, like in our gospel reading today. This story of a king with a heart of gold turns into a story about a god who's really a violent mafia boss, hiring torturers and thugs to haul a man off, to make good on an unpayable debt, a pound of flesh at a time, we can presume. The god of love and grace, we like that guy well enough, but this angry god of judgment, so intent on exposing our failures, our hypocrisy, what a downer. Is this the comfort of Scripture they keep telling me about? It's easy enough to like this benevolent king, this generous lord, but this other guy? I mean, torturers? Really? Like I said, this can be a tough sell. So today, I propose that we approach this parable of the unforgiving servant with a readiness to embrace and receive the grace of the story. And then in the third act, even when the story takes that shocking turn, may we have ears to hear. May we hear the voice of Jesus. Give us ears, Lord. Okay, then. The occasion of this parable is good old-fashioned power struggle, ego, and argument amongst the faithful. Matthew chapter 18 begins with the disciples arguing about who would be the greatest in the kingdom. Jesus responds with a call to childlike faith and a parable about a lost sheep. Humility like a child, not posturing. Caring for and protecting the least, not aspiring to be the greatest. Long shot efforts to care for the little ones, the lost ones. Later in the chapter, Jesus addresses the way that a community can deal with conflict. And it seems Jesus doesn't have any illusions here. People in community are people in conflict, one way or another. Squabbles and quarrels, wrongs and troubles. The way to live in the Jesus community includes instructions on how to keep it and how to do it. He's not glossing over any realities of life. He anticipates the struggles, he anticipates the conflicts, and even anticipates our failures as community. Our failures as the church, our failures as individuals called back to relationships by others, our reliance on the community when we blow it. In many ways, this seems more like Jesus the realist, Jesus the wise sage with words of pastoral wisdom for squabbling followers. The one who knows that the journey for them will not be easy gives them some instructions on maintenance and upkeep, courage and confrontation. And then Peter came and said to him, "Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? As many as 7 times? Jesus said to him, "No, 70 times. I mean, not 7 times, but I tell you, 77 times. Many have suggested that Peter was looking for the reasonable limits to forgiveness. Following God's example in the book of Amos, many in Israel considered forgiveness 3 times to be the divine standard. In this view, Peter is doubling the going rate and adding 1. Really, looks like Peter's catching on. The church needs to forgive a lot, right? Still, others have noted that in Judaism, the number 7 is a deeply symbolic and holy number, a number associated with perfection and completion. Time and again in the scriptures, 7 is the number that points to the divine, God's number. In this view, Peter, quite impressively, I might add, is asking if we need to practice perfect forgiveness. Jesus' response of 70, or in some translations, 70 times 7, upends Peter's extremely optimistic suggestion. Beyond generous forgiveness? Beyond perfect forgiveness? Forgiveness that is somehow more than perfect? Perfecter? Now, I know that's not a word, Peter, Jesus says. And 7 is not a bad start, but you need to try and think of a number that's too big to think of. Peter, prepare to have your mind blown. And so we have. The kingdom of heaven is like, in 3 acts, a parabolic teaching story by Jesus. Act 1. A slave owes the king a lot of money. How much money, you say? For a start, Jesus uses the number 10,000, which would have been considered in the Greek world sort of the biggest number you can get. And then he says the talent, 10,000 talents. That's the largest measure of weight or currency. This isn't a real live number, people. This is a comic book villain super number. This is a bazillion, zillion, gajillion dollars. A slave couldn't live long enough to spend enough to owe that kind of money in many lifetimes. 10,000 talents is 60 million denarii. So if 1 denarii is a day's wage, this laborer or slave would need to work for 164,000 years to repay the debt. Even after taking in all the taxes, big spender Herod the Great, his annual salary, 900 talents. Any notion of repayment is beyond ludicrous. The sum of 10,000 talents is a gross exaggeration, ridiculous, an unpayable sum, an over-the-top bit of exaggeration on Jesus' part. Sure, sell yourself, sell all your possessions, sell your wife and your kids, and you won't even be close to paying it off. Not by a long shot. So the slave fell on his knees before him, saying, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you everything." And out of pity for him, the Lord of that slave released him and forgave him the debt. Before this story is anything else, this is a parable of great generosity, of mercy beyond comprehension. Not a debt reduced, not a payment plan revised, not a renegotiation. There's no running the numbers here. The king's mercy and forgiveness is beyond measure. Act 2. The response of this servant is as exaggerated and ridiculous as the sum he was forgiven. Our protagonist re-enters those mean city streets, and he wastes no time in calling the debts that are owed to him. And so he proceeds to violently assault and choke his fellow slave and throw him into prison. All over the matter of a very feasible, but by no means unreasonable sum of 100 denarii, 100 days' wages. Even as this fellow slave begs for mercy, in the same way that he had in Act 1. And it seems that the irony is just wasted on, really, this clueless thug. Jesus makes every effort to contrast this king's great mercy and the petty smallness of this clueless slave. Let me get to Act 3. Then this Lord summoned him and said to him, "You wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you?" In anger, this Lord handed him over to be tortured until he would pay the entire debt. The king hears of this ridiculously brutal travesty and decides that since this slave is so keen on keeping the books in line, so eager to see debts paid in full, unwilling to extend mercy, even as the recipient of mercy beyond imagining, in anger, the king decides to give the slave what he asked for, a balancing of the books, a reckoning of accounts, payment received in full. And the curtain closes as the slave is dragged away by some sadistic henchmen wearing an apron and carrying pliers. And then Jesus looks to Peter and says, "So my heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother and sister from your heart." Gulp. There stands Peter, gobsmacked, along with the rest of us, disciples, the church, believers through the ages, who've been game to live this Jesus way. People who know that forgiveness, real forgiveness, feels like someone has reached inside us and torn out a piece of who we are. People who know that sometimes our best friends are our grudges. People who know just how scary and cruel and dangerous and mean this world can be. And people who know how dysfunctional the church can be. Such a simple parable, spelled out with such drastic exaggeration, there's no way to miss the point. This is not a story on the limits of forgiveness. It is a parable that shows us the paramount necessity of forgiveness and the absurd selfishness of a failure to live it. Profoundly graced people who refuse to live in grace, recipients of great mercy who continue to withhold mercy. If you thought there was a formula or a metric or a limited powertrain warranty on forgiveness, you aren't thinking big enough. You're looking for numbers that are beyond counting because we've been given grace beyond measure. And the awkward bit here, the part that makes this such a scary story, well, we've had almost 2,000 years of church life and polity and potlucks and services to demonstrate our ongoing failure in this department. We don't even need to look that far, do we? Our own lives are pocked with plenty of examples in the ways that our mercy and our forgiveness and our grace don't measure up. So is the point of this parable that all of our gooses are cooked? If we take this parable literally, I guess that's what it means. That's what it means. It sure seems like it. Is God a king laying in wait with his torturers? Well, I won't for a second pretend to know what final judgment looks like. And I don't for one second want to suggest that God's anger shouldn't be taken seriously. Evil is real in our world. But I don't think this is a parable about a God torturing us. I think this is about the extravagant lengths that Jesus will go to express the seriousness of living out the grace we have received. And it's about the practice of living as recipients of mercy every day. Jesus gives us a glimpse of this daily exercise when he taught us to pray his prayer and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Our forgiveness is linked to our forgiving. And it's no secret, forgiveness is a complicated thing. It's messy, it's difficult, and through it all, we are called to care for the lost and the last and the least. It does not make us doormats. Forgiveness is a process. And forgiveness is a part of our nightly prayers, our morning prayers, and our weekly confession. It is a part of our life together as people, day after day, week after week. Grace and mercy is a posture and a practice. And it's the way of life that marks God's people. People who still say, maybe every day, maybe several times a day, Lord, have mercy. This is the way of life for graced ones, baptized in water and spirit, fed at the table of the Lord, surrounded by a myriad of signs of God's abundant and generous grace. And as we live in this mercy, as we glimpse the horizon of the grace we've received, God's people are made new. The Lord be with you.